leapt into the white foam and ran towards him. But Earendil was sorrowful, for he feared the anger of the lords of the West upon any of Middle-earth that should dare to pass the leaguer of Ammon. And there they bade farewell to the companions of their voyage, and were taken from them forever. Then Earendil said to Elwing, "Await me here, for one only may bring the message that it is my fate to bear." And he went up alone into the land, and came into the Kalakiria, and it seemed to him empty and silent. For even as Morgoth and Ungoliant came in ages past, so now Earendil had come at a time of festival, and well nigh all the elven folk were gone to Valimar, or were gathered in the halls of Manwë upon Tani Quetil, and few were left to keep watch upon the walls of Tirion. But some there were who saw him from afar, and the great light that he bore, and they went in haste to Valimar. But Earendil climbed the green hill of Tuna, and found it bare, and he entered into the streets of Tirion, and they were empty, and his heart was heavy, for he feared that some evil had come even to the blessed realm. He walked in the deserted ways of Tirion, and the dust upon his raiment and his shoes was a dust of diamonds, and he shone and glistened as he climbed the long white stairs. And he called aloud in many tongues, both of elves and men, but there were none to answer him. Therefore he turned back at last towards the sea. But even as he took the shoreward road, one stood upon the hill and called to him in a great voice, crying, "Hail, Earendil, of mariners most renowned, the looked-for that cometh at unawares, the longed-for that cometh beyond hope. Hail, Earendil, bearer of light before the sun and moon, splendor of the children of earth, star in the darkness, jewel in the sunset, radiant in the morning." That voice was the voice of Eonwë, herald of Manwë. And he came from Valimar, and summoned Earendil to come before the powers of Arda. And Earendil went into Valinor, and to the halls of Valimar, and never again set foot upon the lands of men. Then the Valar took counsel together, and they summoned Ulmo from the deeps of the sea. And Earendil stood before their faces, and delivered the errand of the two kindreds. Pardon, he asked, for the Noldor, and pity for their great sorrows, and mercy upon men and elves, and succor in their need. And his prayer was granted. It is told among the elves that after Earendil had departed, seeking Elwing his wife, Mandos spoke concerning his fate, and he said, "Shall mortal man step living upon the undying lands and yet live?" But Ulmo said, "For this he was born into the world, and say unto me, whether is he Earendil Tuor's son of the line of Hador, or the son of Idril, Turgon's daughter of the elven house of Finwë?" And Mandos answered, "Equally the Noldor who went wilfully into exile may not return hither." But when all was spoken, Manwë gave judgment, and he said, "In this matter the power of doom is given to me. The peril that he ventured for love of the two kindreds shall not fall upon Earendil, nor shall it fall upon Elwing his wife, who entered into peril for love of him. But they shall not walk again ever among elves or men in the outer lands, and this is my decree concerning them. To Earendil and to Elwing and to their sons shall be given leave each to choose freely to which kindred their fates shall be joined, and under which kindred they shall be judged." Now when Earendil was long time gone, Elwing became lonely and afraid, and wandering by the margin of the sea she came near to Alqualandë, where lay the Teleri fleets. There the Teleri befriended her, and they listened to her tales of Doriath and Gondolin, and the griefs of Beleriand, and they were filled with pity and wonder. And there Earendil, returning, found her at the haven of the swans. But ere long they were summoned to Valimar, and there the decree of the Elder King was declared to them. Then Earendil said to Elwing, "Choose thou, for now I am weary of the world." And Elwing chose to be judged among the firstborn children of Ilúvatar, because of Lúthien, and for her sake Earendil chose alike, though his heart was rather with the kindred of men and the people of his father. Then at the bidding of the Valar, Eonwë went to the shore of Aman, where the companions of Earendil still remained awaiting tidings. And he took a boat, and the three mariners were set therein, and the Valar drove them away into the east with a great wind. But they took Vingilot, and hallowed it, and bore it away through Valinor to the uttermost rim of the world. And there it passed through the door of night, and was lifted up even into the oceans of heaven. Now fair and marvellous was that vessel made, and it was filled with a wavering flame, pure and bright. And Earendil the mariner sat at the helm, glistening with dust of elven gems, and the Silmaril was bound upon his brow. Far he journeyed in that ship, even into the starless voids, but most often was he seen at morning or at evening, glimmering in sunrise or sunset, as he came back to Valinor from voyages beyond the confines of the world. On these journeys Elwing did not go, for she might not endure the cold and the pathless voids, and she loved rather the earth than the sweet winds that blow on sea and hill. Therefore there was built for her a white tower northward upon the borders of the sundering seas, and thither at times all the sea-birds of the earth repaired. And it is said that Elwing learned the tongues of birds, who herself had once worn their shape, and they taught her the craft of flight, and her wings were of white and silver-grey. And at times, when Earendil, returning, drew near again to Arda, she would fly to meet him, even as she had flown long ago, when she was rescued from the sea. Then the far-sighted among the elves that dwelt in the lonely isle would see her like a white bird, shining, rose-stained in the sunset, as she soared in joy to greet the coming of Vingilot to Haven. Now when first Vingilot was set to sail in the seas of heaven, it rose unlooked for, glittering and bright. And the people of Middle-earth beheld it from afar and wondered, and they took it for a sign, and called it Gil-Estel, the Star of High Hope. And when this new star was seen at evening, Maedhros spoke to Maglor, his brother, and he said, "Surely that is a Silmaril that shines now in the west." And Maglor answered, "If it be truly the Silmaril which we saw cast into the sea that rises again by the power of the Valar, then let us be glad. For its glory is seen now by many, and is yet secure from all evil." Then the elves looked up and despaired no longer. But Morgoth was filled with doubt. Yet it is said that Morgoth looked not for the assault that came upon him from the west, for so great was his pride become that he deemed that none would ever again come with open war against him. Moreover, he thought that he had for ever estranged the Noldor from the lords of the west, and that content in their blissful realm the Valar would heed no more his kingdom in the world without. For to him that is pitiless, the deeds of pity are ever strange and beyond reckoning. But the host of the Valar prepared for battle, and beneath their white banners marched the Vanyar, the people of Ingwe, and those also of the Noldor who never departed from Valinor, whose leader was Finarfin, the son of Finwë. Few of the Teleri were willing to go forth to war, for they remembered the slaying at the Swan Haven and the rape of their ships. But they hearkened to Elwing, who was the daughter of Dior Elúchil, and come of their own kindred, and they sent mariners enough to sail the ships that bore the host of Valinor east over the sea. Yet they stayed aboard their vessels, and none of them set foot upon the hither lands. Of the march of the host of the Valar to the north of Middle-earth, little is said in any tale, for among them went none of those elves who had dwelt and suffered in the hither lands, and who made the histories of those days that still are known. And tidings of these things they only learned long afterwards from their kinsfolk in Ammon. But at the last, the might of Valinor came up out of the west, and the challenge of the trumpets of Eonwë filled the sky, and Beleriand was ablaze with the glory of their arms. For the host of the Valar were arrayed in forms young and fair and terrible, and the mountains rang beneath their feet. The meeting of the hosts of the west and of the north is named the Great Battle and the War of Wrath. There was marshalled the whole power of the throne of Morgoth, and it had become great beyond count, so that Anfauglith could not contain it, and all the north was aflame with war. But it availed him not. The Balrogs were destroyed, save some few that fled and hid themselves in caverns inaccessible at the roots of the earth. And the uncounted legions of the orcs perished like straw in a great fire, or were swept like shriveled leaves before a burning wind. Few remained to trouble the world for long years after. And such few as were left of the three houses of the elf friends, fathers of men, fought upon the part of the Valar, and they were avenged in those days for Baragund and Barahir, Galdor and Gondor, Huor and Húrin, and many others of their lords. But a great part of the sons of men, whether of the people of Uldor or others new come out of the east, marched with the enemy, and the elves do not forget it. Then, seeing that his hosts were overthrown and his power dispersed, Morgoth quailed, and he dared not come forth himself. But he loosed upon his foes the last desperate assault that he had prepared, and out of the pits of Angband there issued the winged dragons that had not before been seen. And so sudden and ruinous was the onset of that dreadful fleet that the hosts of the Valar were driven back. For the coming of the dragons was with great thunder and lightning and a tempest of fire. But Earendil came, shining with white flame, and about Vingilot were gathered all the great birds of heaven, and Thorondor was their captain, and there was battle in the air all the day and through a dark night of doubt. Before the rising of the sun, Earendil slew Ancalagan the Black, the mightiest of the dragon host, and cast him from the sky, and he fell upon the towers of Thangorodrim, and they were broken in his ruin. Then the sun rose, and the host of the Valar prevailed, and well nigh all the dragons were destroyed, and all the pits of Morgoth were broken and unroofed, and the might of the Valar descended into the deeps of the earth. There Morgoth stood at last at bay, and yet unvaliant. He fled into the deepest of his minds and sued for peace and pardon. But his feet were hewn from under him, and he was hurled upon his face. Then he was bound with the chain and Gainor, which he had worn aforetime, and his iron crown they beat into a collar for his neck, and his head was bowed upon his knees, and the two Silmarils which remained to Morgoth were taken from his crown, and they shone unsullied beneath the sky, and Eonwë took them and guarded them. Thus an end was made of the power of Angband in the north, and the evil realm was brought to naught. And out of the deep prisons a multitude of slaves came forth beyond all hope into the light of day, and they looked upon a world that was changed. For so great was the fury of those adversaries that the northern regions of the western world were rent asunder, and the sea roared in through many chasms, and there was confusion and great noise. And rivers perished or found new paths, and the valleys were upheaved, and the hills trod down, and Sirion was no more. Then Eonwë, as herald of the Elder King, summoned the elves of Beleriand to depart from Middle-earth. But Maedhros and Maglor would not hearken, and they prepared, though now with weariness and loathing, to attempt in despair the fulfilment of their oath, for they would have given battle for the Silmarils were they withheld, even against the victorious host of Valinor, even though they stood alone against all the world. And they sent a message, therefore, to Eonwë, bidding him yield up now those jewels which of old Feanor their father made, and Morgoth stole from him. But Eonwë answered that the right to the work of their father, which the sons of Feanor formerly possessed, had now perished, because of their many and merciless deeds being blinded by their oath, and most of all, because of their slaying of Dior and the assault upon the Havens. The light of the Silmarils should go now into the west, whence it came in the beginning, and to Valinor must Maedhros and Maglor return, and there abide the judgment of the Valar, by whose decree alone would Eonwë yield the jewels from his charge. Then Maglor desired indeed to submit, for his heart was sorrowful, and he said, "The oath says not that we may not bide our time, and it may be that in Valinor all shall be forgiven and forgot, and we shall come into our own in peace." But Maedhras answered that if they return to Amon, but the favor of the Valar were withheld from them, then their oath would still remain, but its fulfillment be beyond all hope. And he said, "Who can tell to what dreadful doom we shall come if we disobey the powers in their own land, or purpose ever to bring war again into their holy realm?" Yet Maglor still held back, saying, "If Manwë and Varda themselves deny the fulfillment of an oath to which we named them in witness, is it not made void?" And Maedhros answered, "But how shall our voices reach to Ilúvatar beyond the circles of the world? And by Ilúvatar we swore in our madness and called the everlasting darkness upon us if we kept not our word. Who shall release us?" "If none can release us," said Maglor, "then indeed the everlasting darkness shall be our lot, whether we keep our oath or break it. But less evil shall we do in the breaking." Yet he yielded at last to the will of Maedhros, and they took counsel together how they should lay hands on the Silmarils. And they disguised themselves and came in the night to the camp of Eonwë, and crept into the place where the Silmarils were guarded. And they slew the guards and laid hands on the jewels. Then all the camp was raised against them, and they prepared to die, defending themselves until the last. But Eonwë would not permit the slaying of the sons of Feanor, and departing unfought, they fled far away. Each of them took to himself a Silmaril, for they said, "Since one is lost to us, and but two remain, and we two alone of our brothers, so is it plain that fate would have us share the heirlooms of our father." But the jewel burned the hand of Maedhros in pain unbearable, and he perceived that it was as Eonwë had said, and that his right thereto had become void, and that the oath was vain. And being in anguish and despair, he cast himself into a gaping chasm filled with fire, and so ended. And the Silmaril that he bore was taken into the bosom of the earth. And it is told of Maglor that he could not endure the pain with which the Silmaril tormented him, and he cast it at last into the sea, and thereafter he wandered ever upon the shores, singing in pain and regret beside the waves. For Maglor was mighty among the singers of old, named only after Daeron of Doriath. But he came never back among the people of the elves. And thus it came to pass that the Silmarils found their long homes, one in the airs of heaven, and one in the fires of the heart of the world, and one in the deep waters. In those days there was a great building of ships upon the shores of the western sea, and thence in many a fleet the Eldar set sail into the west, and came never back to the lands of weeping and of war. And the Vanyar returned beneath their white banners, and were borne in triumph to Valinor. But their joy in victory was diminished, for they returned without the Silmarils from Morgoth's crown, and they knew that those jewels could not be found or brought together again, unless the world be broken and remade. And when they came into the west, the elves of Beleriand dwelt upon Tol Eressëa, the lonely isle, that looks both west and east, whence they might come even to Valinor. They were admitted again to the love of Manwë, and the pardon of the Valar, and the Teleri forgave their ancient grief, and the curse was laid to rest. Yet not all the Eldalia were willing to forsake the hither lands where they had long suffered and long dwelt, and some lingered many an age in Middle-earth. Among those were Círdan the shipwright, and Celeborn of Doriath, with Galadriel his wife, who alone remained of those who led the Noldor to exile in Beleriand. In Middle-earth dwelt also Gil-galad the High King, and with him was Elrond, half-elven, who chose, as was granted to him, to be numbered among the Eldar. But Elros, his brother, chose to abide with men, and from these brethren alone has come among men the blood of the firstborn, and the strain of the spirits divine that were before Arda, for they were the sons of Elwing, Dior's daughter, Luthien's son, child of Thingol and Melian. And Earendil, their father, was the son of Idril Celebrimdal, Torgon's daughter of Gondolin. But Morgoth himself, the Valar, thrust through the door of night beyond the walls of the world into the timeless void, and a guard is set forever on those walls, and Earendil keeps watch upon the ramparts of the sky. Yet the lies that Melkor, the mighty and accursed, Morgoth Bauglir, the power of terror and of hate, sowed in the hearts of elves and men, are a seed that does not die and cannot be destroyed. And ever and anon it sprouts anew, and will bear dark fruit even unto the latest days. Here ends the Silmarillion. If it has passed from the high and the beautiful to darkness and ruin, that was of old the fate of Arda Maad, and if any change shall come and the marring be amended, Manwë and Varda may know. But they have not revealed it, and it is not declared in the dunes of Mandos. Akalabeth, the downfall of Numenor. It is said by the Eldar that men came into the world in the time of the shadow of Morgoth, and they fell swiftly under his dominion. For he sent his emissaries among them, and they listened to his evil and cunning words, and they worshipped the darkness, and yet feared it. But there were some that turned from evil, and left the lands of their kindred, and wandered ever westward. For they had heard a rumour that in the west there was a light which the shadow could not dim. The servants of Morgoth pursued them with hatred, and their ways were long and hard. Yet they came at last to the lands that look upon the sea, and they entered Beleriand in the days of the War of the Jewels. The Edain, these were named in the Sindarin tongue, and they became friends and allies of the Eldar, and did deeds of great valour in the war against Morgoth. Of them was sprung, upon the side of his fathers, bright Earendil, and in the lay of Earendil it is told how at the last, when the victory of Morgoth was almost complete, he built his ship Vingilot, that men called Hrothinsil, and voyaged upon the unsailed seas, seeking ever for Valinor. For he desired to speak before the powers on behalf of the two kindreds, that the Valar might have pity on them, and send them help in their uttermost need. Therefore, by elves and men, he is called Earendil the Blessed, for he achieved his quest after long labours and many perils, and from Valinor there came the host of the Lords of the West. But Earendil came never back to the lands that he had loved. In the great battle, when at last Morgoth was overthrown and Thangorodrim was broken, the Edain alone of the kindreds of men fought for the Valar, whereas many others fought for Morgoth. And after the victory of the Lords of the West, those of the evil men who were not destroyed fled back into the East, where many of their race were still wandering in the unharvested lands, wild and lawless, refusing alike the summons of the Valar and of Morgoth. And the evil men came among them, and cast over them a shadow of fear, and they took them for kings. Then the Valar forsook for a time the men of Middle-earth, who had refused their summons and had taken the friends of Morgoth to be their masters. And men dwelt in darkness and were troubled by many evil things that Morgoth had devised in the days of his dominion. Demons and dragons and misshapen beasts and the unclean orcs that are mockeries of the children of Ilúvatar, and the lot of men was unhappy. But Manwë put forth Morgoth and shut him beyond the world in the void that is without, and he cannot himself return again into the world, present and visible, while the Lords of the West are still enthroned. Yet the seeds that he had planted still grew and sprouted, bearing evil fruit, if any would tend them. For his will remained, and guided his servants, moving them ever to thwart the will of the Valar, and to destroy those that obeyed them. This the Lords of the West knew full well. When therefore Morgoth had been thrust forth, they held counsel concerning the ages that should come after. The Eldar they summoned to return into the West, and those that hearkened to the summons dwelt in the Isle of Eressëa. And there is in that land a haven that is named Avalone, for it is of all cities the nearest to Valinor, and the Tower of Avalone is the first sight that the mariner beholds when at last he draws nigh to the undying lands over the leagues of the sea. To the fathers of men, of the three faithful houses, rich reward also was given. Eonwë came among them and taught them, and they were given wisdom and power and life more enduring than any others of mortal race have possessed. A land was made for the Edain to dwell in, neither part of Middle-earth nor of Valinor, for it was sundered from either by a wide sea, yet it was nearer to Valinor. It was raised by Asse out of the depths of the great water, and it was established by Aula and enriched by Yavanna. And the Eldar brought thither flowers and fountains out of Tol Eressëa. That land the Valar called Andor, the land of gift. And the star of Earendil shone bright in the west as a token that all was made ready, and as a guide over the sea, and men marvelled to see that silver flame in the paths of the sun. Then the Edain set sail upon the deep waters, following the star. And the Valar laid a peace upon the sea for many days, and sent sunlight and a sailing wind, so that the waters glittered before the eyes of the Edain like rippling glass, and the foam flew like snow before the stems of their ships. But so bright was Hrothinsil that even at morning men could see it glimmering in the west, and in the cloudless night it shone alone, for no other star could stand beside it. And setting their course towards it, the Edain came at last over leagues of sea and saw afar the land that was prepared for them, Andor, the land of gift, shimmering in a golden haze. Then they went up out of the sea, and found a country fair and fruitful, and they were glad. And they called that land Elenna, which is starwards, but also Anadun, which is westerness, Numenore, in the high Eldarin tongue. This was the beginning of that people that in the grey elven speech are called the Dunedain, the Numenoreans, kings among men. But they did not thus escape from the doom of death that Iluvatar had set upon all mankind, and they were mortal still, though their years were long, and they knew no sickness ere the shadow fell upon them. Therefore they grew wise and glorious, and in all things more like to the firstborn than any other of the kindreds of men. And they were tall, taller than the tallest of the sons of Middle-earth, and the light of their eyes was like the bright stars. But their numbers increased only slowly in the land, for though daughters and sons were born to them, fairer than their fathers, yet their children were few. Of old, the chief city and haven of Numenor was in the midst of its western coasts, and it was called Anduinia, because it faced the sunset. But in the midst of the land was a mountain tall and steep, and it was named the Meneltarma, the Pillar of Heaven, and upon it was a high place that was hallowed to Eru Iluvatar, and it was open and unroofed, and no other temple or fane was there in the land of the Numenoreans. At the feet of the mountain were built the tombs of the kings, and hard by, upon a hill, was Armenelos, fairest of cities, and there stood the tower and the citadel that was raised by Elros, son of Eärendil, whom the Valar appointed to be the first king of the Dúnedain. Now Elros and Elrond his brother were descended from the three houses of the Edain, but in part also both from the Eldar and the Maiar. For Idril of Gondolin and Lúthien, daughter of Melian, were their foremothers. The Valar indeed may not withdraw the gift of death which comes to men from Iluvatar, but in the matter of the half-elven, Iluvatar gave to them the judgment. And they judged that to the sons of Eärendil should be given choice of their own destiny. And Elrond chose to remain with the firstborn, and to him the life of the firstborn was granted. But to Elros, who chose to be a king of men, still a great span of years was allotted, many times that of the men of Middle-earth. And all his line, the kings and lords of the royal house, had long life, even according to the measure of the Numenoreans. But Elros lived 500 years, and ruled the Numenoreans 410. Thus the years passed, and while Middle-earth went backward and light and wisdom faded, the Dúnedain dwelt under the protection of the Valar, and in the friendship of the Eldar, and they increased in stature both of mind and body. For though this people used still their own speech, their kings and lords knew and spoke also the elven tongue, which they had learned in the days of their alliance, and thus they held converse still with the Eldar, whether of Eressëa or of the westlands of Middle-earth. And the lore-masters among them learned also the high Eldarin tongue of the Blessed Realm, in which much story and song was preserved from the beginning of the world. And they made letters and scrolls and books, and wrote in them many things of wisdom and wonder in the high tide of their realm, of which all is now forgot. So it came to pass that, beside their own names, all the lords of the Numenoreans had also Eldarin names, and the like with the cities and fair places that they founded in Numenor, and on the shores of the hither lands. For the Dúnedain became mighty in crafts, so that if they had had the mind, they could easily have surpassed the evil kings of Middle-earth in the making of war and the forging of weapons. But they were become men of peace. Above all arts they nourished shipbuilding and sea-craft, and they became mariners whose like shall never be again since the world was diminished. And voyaging upon the wide seas was the chief feat and adventure of their hardy men in the gallant days of their youth. But the lords of Valinor forbade them to sail so far westward that the coasts of Numenor could no longer be seen. And for long the Dúnedain were content, though they did not fully understand the purpose of this ban. But the design of Manwë was that the Numenoreans should not be tempted to seek for the Blessed Realm, nor desire to overpass the limits set to their bliss, becoming enamoured of the immortality of the Valar, and the Eldar, and the lands where all things endure. For in those days Valinor still remained in the world visible, and there Ilúvatar permitted the Valar to maintain upon earth an abiding place, a memorial of that which might have been if Morgoth had not cast his shadow on the world. This the Númenóreans knew full well, and at times, when all the air was clear and the sun was in the east, they would look out and descry far off in the west a city white shining on a distant shore and a great harbour and a tower. For in those days the Númenóreans were far-sighted. Yet even so it was only the keenest eyes among them that could see this vision from the Meneltarma, maybe, or from some tall ship that lay off their western coast as far as it was lawful for them to go. For they did not dare to break the ban of the lords of the west. But the wise among them knew that this distant land was not indeed the blessed realm of Valinor, but was Avalonne, the haven of the Eldar upon Eressëa, easternmost of the undying lands. And thence at times the firstborn still would come sailing to Númenor in oarless boats as white birds flying from the sunset. And they brought to Númenor many gifts, birds of song and fragrant flowers and herbs of great virtue. And a seedling they brought of Celeborn, the white tree that grew in the midst of Eressëa, and that was in its turn a seedling of Galathilion, the tree of Tuna, the image of Telperion that Yavanna gave to the Eldar in the Blessed Realm. And the tree grew and blossomed in the courts of the king in Armenelos. Nimloth, it was named, and flowered in the evening, and the shadows of night it filled with its fragrance. Thus it was that because of the ban of the Valar, the voyages of the Dúnedain in those days went ever eastward and not westward, from the darkness of the north to the heats of the south, and beyond the south to the nether darkness. And they came even into the inner seas, and sailed about Middle-earth, and glimpsed from their high prows the gates of morning in the east. And the Dúnedain came at times to the shores of the great lands, and they took pity on the forsaken world of Middle-earth. And the lords of Númenor set foot again upon the western shores in the dark years of men, and none yet dared to withstand them. For most of the men of that age that sat under the shadow were now grown weak and fearful. And coming among them, the Númenóreans taught them many things. Corn and wine they brought, and they instructed men in the sowing of seed and the grinding of grain, in the hewing of wood and the shaping of stone, and in the ordering of their life, such as it might be in the lands of swift death and little bliss. Then the men of Middle-earth were comforted, and here and there upon the western shores the houseless woods drew back, and men shook off the yoke of the offspring of Morgoth, and unlearned their terror of the dark. And they revered the memory of the tall sea kings, and when they had departed they called them gods, hoping for their return. For at that time the Númenóreans dwelt never long in Middle-earth, nor made there as yet any habitation of their own. Eastward they must sail, but ever west their hearts returned. Now this yearning grew ever greater with the years, and the Númenóreans began to hunger for the undying city that they saw from afar, and the desire of everlasting life to escape from death, and the ending of delight grew strong upon them. And ever as their power and glory grew greater, their unquiet increased. For though the Valar had rewarded the Dúnedain with long life, they could not take from them the weariness of the world that comes at last, and they died, even their kings of the seed of Earendil, and the span of their lives was brief in the eyes of the Eldar. Thus it was that a shadow fell upon them, in which maybe the will of Morgoth was at work that still moved in the world. And the Númenóreans began to murmur, at first in their hearts, and then in open words, against the doom of men, and most of all against the ban, which forbade them to sail into the west. And they said among themselves, Why do the lords of the West sit there in peace unending, while we must die and go we know not whither, leaving our home and all that we have made? And the Eldar die not, even those that rebelled against the lords. And since we have mastered all seas, and no water is so wild or so wide that our ships cannot overcome it, why should we not go to Avalone, and greet there our friends? And some there were who said, Why should we not go even to Aman, and taste there, were it but for a day, the bliss of the powers? Have we not become mighty among the people of Arda? The Eldar reported these words to the Valar, and Manwë was grieved, seeing a cloud gather on the noontide of Númenor. And he sent messengers to the Dúnedain, who spoke earnestly to the king and to all who would listen, concerning the fate and fashion of the world. "The doom of the world," they said, "one alone can change who made it. And were you so to voyage that escaping all deceits and snares you came indeed to Aman, the blessed realm, little would it profit you. For it is not the land of Manwë that makes its people deathless, but the deathless that dwell therein have hallowed the land. And there you would but wither and grow weary the sooner, as moths in a light too strong and steadfast." But the king said, "And does not Earendil, my forefather, live? Or is he not in the land of Aman?" To which they answered, "You know that he has a fate apart, and was adjudged to the firstborn who die not. Yet this also is his doom, that he can never return again to mortal lands, whereas you and your people are not of the firstborn, but are mortal men, as Ilúvatar made you. Yet it seems that you desire now to have the good of both kindreds, to sail to Valinor when you will, and to return when you please to your homes. That cannot be. Nor can the Valar take away the gifts of Ilúvatar. The Eldar, you say, are unpunished, and even those who rebelled do not die. Yet that is to them neither reward nor punishment, but the fulfillment of their being. They cannot escape, and are bound to this world, never to leave it so long as it lasts, for its life is theirs. And you are punished for the rebellion of men, you say, in which you had small part, and so it is that you die. But that was not at first appointed for a punishment. Thus you escape and leave the world, and are not bound to it in hope or in weariness. Which of us, therefore, should envy the others?" And the Númenóreans answered, "Why should we not envy the Valar, or even the least of the deathless? For of us is required a blind trust and a hope without assurance, knowing not what lies before us in a little while. And yet we also love the earth, and would not lose it." Then the messengers said, "Indeed, the mind of Ilúvatar concerning you is not known to the Valar, and he has not revealed all things that are to come. But this we hold to be true, that your home is not here, neither in the land of Aman, nor anywhere within the circles of the world. And the doom of men, that they should depart, was at first a gift of Ilúvatar. It became a grief to them only because, coming under the shadow of Morgoth, it seemed to them that they were surrounded by a great darkness of which they were afraid. And some grew willful and proud and would not yield until life was reft from them. We who bear the ever-mounting burden of the years do not clearly understand this. But if that grief has returned to trouble you, as you say, then we fear that the shadow arises once more and grows again in your hearts. Therefore, though you be the Dúnedain, fairest of men, who escaped from the shadow of old and fought valiantly against it, we say to you, beware. The will of Eru may not be gainsaid, and the Valar bid you earnestly not to withhold the trust to which you are called, lest soon it become again a bond by which you are constrained. Hope rather that in the end even the least of your desires shall have fruit. The love of Arda was set in your hearts by Ilúvatar, and he does not plant to no purpose. Nonetheless, Many ages of men unborn may pass ere that purpose is made known, and to you it will be revealed, and not to the Valar. These things took place in the days of Tar Kiriatan, the shipbuilder, and of Tar Atanamir, his son. And they were proud men, eager for wealth, and they laid the men of Middle-earth under tribute, taking now rather than giving. It was to Tar Atanamir that the messengers came, and he was the 13th king, and in his day the realm of Numenor had endured for more than 2,000 years, and was come to the zenith of its bliss, if not yet of its power. But Atanamir was ill-pleased with the counsel of the messengers, and gave little heed to it, and the greater part of his people followed him. For they wished still to escape death in their own day, not waiting upon hope. And Atanamir lived to a great age, clinging to his life beyond the end of all joy. And he was the first of the Numenoreans to do this, refusing to depart until he was witless and unmanned, and denying to his son the kingship at the height of his days. For the lords of Numenor had been wont to wed late in their long lives, and to depart and leave the mastery to their sons when these were come to full stature of body and mind. Then Tar Ancalimon, son of Atanamir, became king, and he was of like mind, and in his day the people of Numenor became divided. On the one hand was the greater party, and they were called the king's men, and they grew proud and were estranged from the Eldar and the Valar. And on the other hand was the lesser party, and they were called the Elendili, the elf friends. For though they remained loyal indeed to the king and the house of Elros, they wished to keep the friendship of the Eldar, and they hearkened to the counsel of the lords of the West. Nonetheless, even they, who named themselves the Faithful, did not wholly escape from the affliction of their people, and they were troubled by the thought of death. Thus the bliss of Westerness became diminished. But still its might and splendor increased, for the kings and their people had not yet abandoned wisdom, and if they loved the Valar no longer, at least they still feared them. They did not dare openly to break the ban, or to sail beyond the limits that had been appointed. Eastward still they steered their tall ships. But the fear of death grew ever darker upon them, and they delayed it by all means that they could. And they began to build great houses for their dead, while their wise men labored unceasingly to discover, if they might, the secret of recalling life, or at the least, of the prolonging of men's days. Yet they achieved only the art of preserving incorrupt the dead flesh of men, and they filled all the land with silent tombs, in which the thought of death was enshrined in the darkness. But those that lived turned the more eagerly to pleasure and revelry, desiring ever more goods and more riches. And after the days of Tar and Calimon, the offering of the first fruits to Eru was neglected, and men went seldom any more to the hallow upon the heights of Meneltarma in the midst of the land. Thus it came to pass in that time that the Numenoreans first made great settlements upon the west shores of the ancient lands, for their own land seemed to them shrunken, and they had no rest or content therein, and they desired now wealth and dominion in Middle-earth, since the west was denied. Great harbours and strong towers they made, and there many of them took up their abode. But they appeared now rather as lords and masters and gatherers of tribute than as helpers and teachers. And the great ships of the Numenoreans were borne east on the winds and returned ever laden, and the power and majesty of their kings were increased, and they drank and they feasted, and they clad themselves in silver and gold. In all this the elf friends had small part. They alone came now ever to the north and the land of Gil-galad, keeping their friendship with the elves, and lending them aid against Sauron. And their haven was Pelagir, above the mouths of Anduin the Great. But the king's men sailed far away to the south, and the lordships and strongholds that they made have left many rumours in the legends of men. In this age, as is elsewhere told, Sauron arose again in Middle-earth and grew and turned back to the evil in which he was nurtured by Morgoth, becoming mighty in his service. Already in the days of Tar-Minastir, the 11th king of Numenor, he had fortified the land of Mordor and had built there the tower of Barad-dûr. And thereafter he strove ever for the dominion of Middle-earth, to become a king over all kings and as a god unto men. And Sauron hated the Numenoreans because of the deeds of their fathers and their ancient alliance with the elves and allegiance to the Valar. Nor did he forget the aid that Tar-Minastir had rendered to Gil-galad of old, in that time when the One Ring was forged, and there was war between Sauron and the elves in Eriador. Now he learned that the kings of Numenor had increased in power and splendour, and he hated them the more, and he feared them lest they should invade his lands and wrest from him the dominion of the East. But for a long time he did not dare to challenge the lords of the sea, and he withdrew from the coasts. Yet Sauron was ever guileful, and it is said that among those whom he ensnared with the Nine Rings, three were great lords of Numenorean race. And when the Ulairi arose that were the Ringwraiths, his servants, and the strength of his terror and mastery over men had grown exceedingly great, he began to assail the strong places of the Numenoreans upon the shores of the sea. In those days the shadow grew deeper upon Numenor, and the lives of the kings of the House of Elros waned because of their rebellion, but they hardened their hearts the more against the Valar. And the 19th king took the sceptre of his fathers, and he ascended the throne in the name of Adun Akhor, Lord of the West, forsaking the elven tongues and forbidding their use in his hearing. Yet in the Scroll of Kings, the name Herunumen was inscribed in the high elven speech because of ancient custom, which the kings feared to break utterly, lest evil befall. Now this title seemed to the faithful overproud, being the title of the Valar, and their hearts were sorely tried between their loyalty to the House of Elros and their reverence of the appointed powers. But worse was yet to come. For Ar-Gimilzor, the 22nd king, was the greatest enemy of the faithful. In his day the white tree was untended and began to decline, and he forbade utterly the use of the elven tongues, and punished those that welcomed the ships of Eresea, that still came secretly to the west shores of the land. Now the Elendili dwelt mostly in the western regions of Numenor, but Ar-Gimilzor commanded all that he could discover to be of this party to remove from the west and dwell in the east of the land, and there they were watched. And the chief dwelling of the faithful in the later days was thus nigh to the harbour of Romenna. Thence many set sail to Middle-earth, seeking the northern coasts where they might speak still with the Eldar in the kingdom of Gil-galad. This was known to the kings, but they hindered it not, so long as the Elendili departed from their land and did not return, for they desired to end all friendship between their people and the Eldar of Eresea, whom they named the Spies of the Valar, hoping to keep their deeds and their counsels hidden from the lords of the West. But all that they did was known to Manwë, and the Valar were wroth with the kings of Numenor, and gave them counsel and protection no more. And the ships of Eresea came never again out of the sunset, and the havens of Andunia were forlorn. Highest in honour after the house of the kings were the lords of Andunia, for they were of the line of Elros, being descended from Silmarion, daughter of Tar-Elendil, the 4th king of Numenor. And these lords were loyal to the kings, and revered them. and the Lord of Andunia was ever among the chief counsellors of the sceptre. Yet also from the beginning they bore especial love to the Eldar and reverence for the Valar, and as the shadow grew, they aided the faithful as they could. But for long they did not declare themselves openly, and sought rather to amend the hearts of the lords of the sceptre with wiser counsels. There was a lady, Inzilbeth, renowned for her beauty, and her mother was Lindoria, sister of Eärendur, the lord of Andunia, in the days of Ar-Sakalthor, father of Ar-Gimilsor. Gimilsor took her to wife, though this was little to her liking, for she was in heart one of the faithful, being taught by her mother. But the kings and their sons were grown proud, and not to be gainsaid in their wishes. No love was there between Ar-Gimilsor and his queen, or between their sons. Inziladun, the elder, was like his mother in mind as in body. But Gimilchad, the younger, went with his father, unless he were yet prouder and more wilful. To him Ar-Gimilsor would have yielded the sceptre rather than to the elder son, if the laws had allowed. But when Inziladun acceded to the sceptre, he took again a title in the elven tongue as of old, calling himself Tar-Palantir, for he was far-sighted both in eye and in mind, and even those that hated him feared his words as those of a true seer. He gave peace for a while to the faithful, and he went once more at due seasons to the hallow of Eru upon the Meneltarma, which Ar-Gimilsor had forsaken. The white tree he tended again with honour, and he prophesied, saying that when the tree perished, then also would the line of the kings come to its end. But his repentance was too late to appease the anger of the Valar with the insolence of his fathers, of which the greater part of his people did not repent. And Gimilchad was strong and ungentle, and he took the leadership of those that had been called the king's men, and opposed the will of his brother as openly as he dared, and yet more in secret. Thus the days of Tar-Palantir became darkened with grief, and he would spend much of his time in the west, and there ascended often the ancient tower of King Minas Tir, upon the hill of Oromet, nigh to Andunia, whence he gazed westward in yearning, hoping to see, maybe, some sail upon the sea. But no ship came ever again from the west to Numenor, and Avalone was veiled in cloud. Now Gimilchad died 2 years before his 200th year, which was accounted an early death for one of Elros' line, even in its waning. But this brought no peace to the king. For Pharazôn, son of Gimilchad, had become a man yet more restless and eager for wealth and power than his father. He had fared often abroad as a leader in the wars that the Numenoreans made then in the coastlands of Middle-earth, seeking to extend their dominion over men. And thus he had won great renown as a captain both by land and by sea. Therefore, when he came back to Numenor, hearing of his father's death, the hearts of the people were turned to him, for he brought with him great wealth and was for the time free in his giving. And it came to pass that Tar-Palantir grew weary of grief and died. He had no son, but a daughter only, whom he named Miriel in the elven tongue. And to her now by right and the laws of the Numenoreans came the sceptre. But Pharazôn took her to wife against her will, doing evil in this and evil also, in that the laws of Numenor did not permit the marriage, even in the royal house, of those more nearly akin than cousins in the second degree. And when they were wedded, he seized the sceptre into his own hand, taking the title of Ar-Pharazôn, Tar-Kalion in the elven tongue. And the name of his queen he changed to Ar-Zimrafel. The mightiest and proudest was Ar-Pharazôn the Golden, of all those that had wielded the scepter of the Sea Kings since the foundation of Numenor. And 23 kings and queens had ruled the Numenoreans before, and slept now in their deep tombs under the Mount of Meneltarma, lying upon beds of gold. And sitting upon his carven throne in the city of Armenelos, in the glory of his power,